everyone, and thank you for joining me for this podcast. I'm thrilled to be joined by my A-level biology student, Amelie, who has conducted some incredible research into the condition called endometriosis. Now, this disorder affects a staggering 190 million women worldwide, and yet we still don't really fully understand the cause. But those who suffer with it have to endure incredible pelvic pain, awful period cramps, and often infertility. So in this podcast, Amelie is going to essentially talk through the research that she's found on the causes, the effects, and the potential treatments for this debilitating condition. Amelie, thank you very much for joining me today.
Great, thanks for having me on the channel. So today I'm going to be talking about endometriosis with a focus on the possible causes of endometriosis. So I think a pretty good place to start is what it is. And endometriosis is a disorder when tissue resembling the uterus lining grows outside of the uterus in what's known as ectopic sites. These clumps of tissue are referred to as endometriotic lesions. The disorder affects about 10 to 15% of women globally, and these lesions typically occur in the pelvis, on the ovaries, fallopian tubes, or the peritoneum, which is the membrane that lines the abdomen and pelvis. The disorder can also affect surrounding organs, such as the bladder, but less commonly is when endometriosis grows in atypical sites, such as the lungs, brain, or even the skin. Endometriosis is also considered a chronic illness, as it is a disease that is ongoing in its effect on those who suffer from it, and has a number of common symptoms, including, but not limited to, pelvic pain, especially during a period, pain when urinating or defecating on a period, pain during sex, and difficulty getting pregnant. Next, what I'd like to explore in depth is what causes endometriosis. Why do these lesions grow where they're not supposed to grow? Well, the short answer to that is, I don't know. The cause of endometriosis is not yet fully understood by scientists, but the beauty of medical science is that even when the cause of an issue is not known, that doesn't mean that there isn't a richness of theoretical discussion and research on the issue. On the contrary, scientists are typically very drawn to such mysteries. Therefore, there are lots of interlinking theory on the causes of endometriosis for us to explore. I can start with the most common or accepted one, the popular one, which is called retrograde menstruation. To explain, retrograde menstruation is when menstrual blood during a period flows out of the fallopian tubes into the pelvic cavity as opposed to out of the vagina. And the pelvic cavity is essentially the sac which holds reproductive and excretory organs. What has been theorized is that fragments of menstrual tissue are released outside of the uterus into this cavity due to retrograde menstruation. Parts of this tissue can adhere to the outside of the uterus or the peritoneal surface, and endometriotic lesions can begin to form. And so this theory first came about due to a scientist called John Sampson, and it was and is still considered a revolutionary theory in terms of endometriosis. Since then, scientists have looked deeper into the hypothesis because there are still a lot of questions that need to be answered, such as which cells in menstrual tissue are responsible for the lesions or what is needed for the lesions to grow. So a pretty good first place to look to answer these questions is the composition of menstrual blood. At the time of the introduction of this theory, many assumed that it was only endometrial cells that were responsible for the lesions, but we now know that there are a few issues with that assumption. For a start, endometrial lesions are not just made up of endometrial cells, but different cell types which can contribute to the inflammation associated with the disorder. Secondly, if we take a look at the composition of the blood is very rich in stem cells, specifically mesenchymal stem cells and progenitor cells. This is because during the menstrual cycle, after the uterine lining has been shed, the tissue has to regenerate. In order for this to happen, only the top layer of the uterus lining is actually shed during menstruation. This layer is called the functionalis layer, whereas the bottom remaining layer is called the basalis. It is now believed that stem cells are responsible for this tissue regeneration, as stem cells in the basalis layer can replicate and specialize to form the functionalis layer. Logically, this can very much lead to the possibility that stem cells in menstrual tissue are actually responsible for forming the lesions, as opposed to purely endometrial cells, as they could be the cells that implant in ectopic regions. If you recall, earlier I mentioned stem cells called progenitor cells, which are stem cells that have the ability to form many different types of cells, which means that it's possible that these cells are causing the variety of cells found in endometriotic lesions. Recently, scientists have tried to find evidence for this stem cell theory, and they've found that many cells in endometriotic lesions contain what's called stem cell markers, which are indicators that they originated from stem cells, which is quite credible evidence for this theory. This is a really exciting finding because if we understand the cells causing endometriosis, this can potentially lead to new understanding and treatment of the disorder. Now, part of why this theory is generally accepted is perhaps because it's one of the oldest. However, there have arisen several criticisms of it that lead us to question whether or not it fully explains endometriosis. The first one being that approximately 75 to 90% of women with open or unblocked fallopian tubes will experience retrograde menstruation, but only about 10 to 15% of women worldwide have endometriosis. So there has to be something else to cause the formation of these lesions other than just simply the mechanism of retrograde menstruation. And so I mentioned earlier that there are also theories about the causes of endometriosis that suggest that lesions originate from cells outside of the uterus. It's been theorized that stem cells deriving from the bone marrow can form endometriotic lesions in the same way that progenitor cells do. But that begs the question, how on earth do these stem cells get to the outside of the uterus? One of these ideas is something called lymphovascular translocation. The name is very long, but what it essentially means is that fragments of endometrial tissue are transported outside of the uterus through the bloodstream or the lymphatic system to ectopic sites outside of the uterus. This is actually a very exciting theory for researchers because it provides a potential explanation for a lot of phenomena. For example, endometriosis doesn't always just form on the female reproductive system. It can also, like I said earlier, form on the abdominal wall and even in rare cases on the heart and lungs. Lymphovascular translocation provides a plausible explanation for this, as endometrial tissue could travel in the bloodstream after retrograde menstruation to these other sites in the body. Another popular but quite different theory is called selemic metaplasia. Again, this term sounds very loaded and complicated, but to understand it, we have to recognize that many cells are specialized. For example, we have red blood cells, neurons, liver cells, etc. What selemic metaplasia is when cells can change specialty. So what proponents of this theory think is that specialized cells in the mesophyllial lining of the peritoneum transform to become endometrial cells, and so form endometriotic lesions, because these lesions are made up of many different cell types, not just endometrial cells. So selemic metaplasia offers an explanation as to how all of these cells came to be. I also quite like an idea of a cell just transforming itself in another type of cell, just because. This theory also leads to many more questions as to what caused metaplasia. Immunological and hormonal factors have been vastly credited with this, so I'll go into a bit more detail about the immunology surrounding endometriosis. When researching for the podcast, I found the immunology of endometriosis to be a fascinating but quite cloudy topic. For a start, inflammation is very strongly associated with endometriosis, but it's still disputed whether inflammation is a part of the mechanism of endometriosis or whether it's a response to endometriotic lesions. So it's the question of which came first, the chicken or the egg. But there is still quite a lot of knowledge on this topic. A key player in immunology of endometriosis are these molecules called cytokines, which are small proteins that are imperative in regulating the growth and activity of other immune cells such as phagocytes and blood cells. It's essentially a hormone of the immune system. So if you were to assume that inflammation is a response to endometriosis, cytokines are responsible for this response. It has been theorized that the activation of immune cells in those of endometriosis can trigger signaling, which stimulates inflammatory cytokines, which can be semi-responsible for the accumulation of multiple cell types on and surrounding the endometriotic lesion. And like with every finding, it seems to cause more questions than answers. The main one I was thinking about when researching this was whether immune system dysfunction causes endometriosis or whether endometriosis causes immune system dysfunction. And it seems to be on the mind of a lot of researchers too, but there's nothing yet definitive. One thing that has been established is that immune system dysfunction and endometriosis are linked. Some researchers did find that a condition for the development of endometrial lesions is immune system dysfunction. For example, neutrophils, a type of white blood cells, and peritoneal macrophages, which are blood monocytes, which is another class of white blood cells that have migrated into the peritoneal cavity, can produce certain biochemical factors that contribute to angiogenesis, which is the formation of new blood vessels, and endometriotic cell growth. So that means that these two types of cells contribute to factors that contribute to two phenomena that are very key to endometriosis. So what this essentially means is that there is a key link between the immune system and endometriosis. And hopefully more will be discovered in the future, as this could be the key to treatment. The next aspect of endometriosis to talk about is the genetic factor. Although endometriosis is not really considered a genetic disease, it's generally accepted that there is some kind of correlation there. So before I go on to discuss this, I'll just pause to explain a few key terms, such as the Revised American Society of Reproductive Medicine, or RASRM score. This is a score used to describe how large an endometriosis lesion is. So stages 3 to 4 are respectively moderate and severe, as the lesion is more than 3 centimeters large. Another key term is a single nucleotide polymorphism, which is the most common genetic variation in the human genome. It occurs when there is a change in the DNA sequence, but this change doesn't especially affect the function of the protein which DNA codes for. In other words, they have supposedly no functional effect on our molecular biology. However, this has been called into question when a study which sought to explore the genetic factors behind endometriosis found 19 single nucleotide polymorphisms that were associated with RASRM stages 3 and 4, the most severe stages. This means that these 19 single nucleotide polymorphisms were more likely to be found in women with endometriosis in stages 3 and 4. The locations of the polymorphisms have all been found in the non-coding or junk DNA regions, colloquially, but that means that they are not directly involved in how proteins are formed. They do not form the code, which is then transcripted and translated. But unfortunately, there has not yet been extensive research into what the exact effect these polymorphisms have on gene regulation. So the genetic question has by no means been fully answered. But the association of certain polymorphisms with more severe endometriosis can at least explain why some women get endometriosis and why others don't, and explain the variation of severity. Another factor I mentioned earlier was proliferation rate. It would make sense for endometrial cells in women with endometriosis to have higher proliferation, or that is, replication rate, as the tissue has to embed itself in whatever ectopic region, so it has to be able to grow quickly. When we discuss a high proliferation rate in terms of disease, a disease that often comes to mind is cancer, which is as a result of uncontrolled cell growth. So it is interesting that a study that identified 39 key endometriosis-related genes found that all 39 of the genes identified were associated with the formation of tumours and cancers. However, it is important to differentiate between endometriosis, which is a debilitating but not generally life-threatening disorder, and cancer, which is malignant and tumorous, which can spread to many parts of the body and in many cases be fatal. I thought it would just be interesting to consider some of the shared characteristics of endometriosis and cancer and the genetic link between them. And this could be the key to better understanding how exactly endometriosis begins and develops. So next, I've talked a lot about the theory, but I'd like to essentially move away from that and talk more about how endometriosis is managed in practice. I say managed for the most part and not treated, partly because it is not still fully understood how endometriosis occurs. And without fully comprehending the pathophysiology of a disorder, it is hard to find treatments. Those who have it essentially live with it and the many horrible symptoms that come with it. But there are still ways to reduce the effects of it on daily life. So the most common method of management and most accessible are analgesics, so painkillers. Most common ones are paracetamol and ibuprofen, which can be bought independently without needing a prescription, and codeine can even be prescribed by doctors. Of course, painkillers aren't exclusive to endometriosis. Many of those who menstruate use these to deal with period pains, but these pains are amplified for those with endometriosis. The advantage of painkillers is definitely their accessibility. You can get paracetamol and Nurofen at a pharmacy, but the main disadvantage is limited effectiveness. Even with the highest healthy dosage of painkillers, those with endometriosis suffer terrible pain, which can get to the point where it significantly reduces quality of life. So other management methods have to be looked at. A newer, more exciting approach to treating endometriosis is using hormones. Now, this may seem very sophisticated, but hormonal treatment is actually very common amongst women and girls with endometriosis, and it comes in the form of the birth control pill. See, the hormonal changes brought about by the birth control pill, which aim to prevent ovulation, also cause a reduction in estrogen, which can make periods lighter and less painful, hence alleviating some of the effects of endometriosis. Although a 2017 paper did say that the oral contraceptive pill is not completely effective for endometriosis, many of those who use it certainly report a reduction in pain. Unfortunately, due to the hormonal changes, they also report great mood swings and even depression in a lot of cases. This is why, as you can probably tell, those with endometriosis seriously struggle with finding a way of managing the disorder in a way that doesn't drastically interfere with day-to-day life. There are other hormonal treatments, such as gonadotropin-releasing hormone agonists, and that's a type of medication which switches off the ovaries, preventing periods and suppressing estrogen. Another type are gonadotropin-releasing hormone antagonists, which are slightly newer and haven't really been studied in depth. And finally, what are called aromatase inhibitors. Aromatase inhibitors work by lowering estrogen levels by inhibiting an enzyme called aromatase in fat from converting other hormones to estrogen. These treatments, other than the antagonists, have all been found to be linked to a clinically significant reduction in pain, and the symptoms returned after treatment ended. So there are improvements, and hopefully these treatments can be developed more as a non-invasive and effective approach to be able to treat endometriosis. Unfortunately, hormone treatments can't really reverse the formation of the lesions themselves, which can lead to other problems, and it doesn't help with fertility, unfortunately. In order to combat both of these issues, surgical options are often looked at. Excision surgeries aim to essentially cut out parts of the endometrial lesions while leaving the uterus and reproductive system intact. No lesions, no pain, hopefully. The advantage of doing this is it does get more to the actual root of the problem than painkillers and hormonal treatments, and in some cases this can cure endometriosis if the lesions don't come back. The big problem is that lesions do tend to come back, with a recession rate of about 20% after 2 years and 50% at 5 years. So there is a significant chance that someone who opts for this surgery will get endometriosis again. And considering that the surgery is quite invasive, people with endometriosis may understandably not want to undergo it. Obviously, there are pros and cons to virtually any medical practice, and excision is viewed by much of the medical community as a superior method of surgically treating endometriosis. It appears to be especially effective in cases of what's called deep endometriosis, which is when endometriosis has penetrated more than 5 millimeters under the peritoneum, which again is the membrane lining the abdominal cavity. As can be imagined, these cases of endometriosis are sometimes the most painful, so removal of these lesions for women with deep endometriosis can really help relieve their pain and ameliorate their quality of life. Also, excision surgeries that remove very large lesions can increase pregnancy rate, which is very important considering infertility is something very commonly associated with endometriosis. But on the flip side, excision surgeries can be unsuccessful. These lesions can recur, and so can all the symptoms associated with them. For women in these circumstances, they may opt for a hysterectomy, which is the removal of the uterus. Removing the uterus prevents periods from occurring, and so pain doesn't flare up in the same way after a hysterectomy. Unfortunately, even after a hysterectomy, endometriosis still may occur, as lesions grow outside of the uterus, but it can be a positive step forward in alleviating some of the symptoms. This surgery for endometriosis is generally opted for by older women who have had children and endometriosis, or younger women who know that they do not want children. But there lies the big issue with hysterectomies. They cannot be reversed. Many of those suffering from endometriosis will want children and may not even be ready to decide this yet, as many of those with endometriosis are teenagers. So undertaking this kind of surgery in many cases will not even be an option, and a lot of thought has to be put into the decision. And again, there are all the considerations of having an invasive operation, which someone will need time to recover from, and does carry, like every surgery of this nature, a risk of infection and long-term damage. Again, I'm not advocating for or against any of the treatments of endometriosis, rather I'm just highlighting some of the implications they may have in the future to demonstrate the dilemma that those of endometriosis face. That leads on quite nicely to the last point I wanted to touch on, which is the real-life struggles of having endometriosis. A big one is even just finding out you have it. It takes 9 years on average from the disorder starting to getting a formal diagnosis. To put that into context, that is 9 years of suffering debilitating pain in many cases, pain that can prevent you from going about your daily life and even lower your quality of life without knowing why. A common reason for this is that endometriosis is often mistaken for severe period pains by both patients and doctors. Symptoms of endometriosis do tend to flare up during periods, so some women with awful pain that is due to endometriosis might just think that they have bad periods. This is partly due to how pain is somewhat arbitrary. What may be horrible pain for someone might be quite manageable for someone else, but there are, in my opinion, more changeable factors at fault as well. One is lack of education about endometriosis. In a survey done with women and girls aged 16 to 24 years old in the UK, 62% of women did not know what endometriosis was. That's just more than 3 in 5 women and girls. Just to draw your attention back to the beginning, approximately 10 to 15% of all women worldwide have endometriosis. So statistically speaking, there is a very good chance that many of these women and girls have endometriosis, but because of the lack of education surrounding it, they don't even know what it is. This lack of knowledge arguably also extends to the scientific and medical community as well. An article in the National Institute of Health describes endometriosis as the missed disease, both in terms of the scientific understanding of the pathophysiology behind endometriosis and its diagnosis. Many women who have now, finally, been diagnosed with endometriosis report to being repeatedly dismissed by doctors when their symptoms persisted. These doctors, specifically, appeared to view these women as dramatic or that they were, quote-unquote, complaining too much about nothing. But in reality, there was a chronic illness behind their pain. So in order to combat this, I think that there are many things that can be done. Firstly, there's education. Endometriosis, like many period-related disorders, should not be stigmatised or be treated as something taboo or embarrassing, but something that we can rather be much more open about as a society, to empower people to be much more open about their painful periods so that they can be diagnosed quicker than in 9 years. Secondly, some doctors must confront their own attitudes about pain, particularly in women, and seek to listen to their patients when they tell them that there is a problem. Not only would that improve trust between a doctor and patient, but more importantly, it would truly benefit and validate a patient and create a path to alleviating their suffering. Thank you so much for listening. If you want more information on endometriosis, please go to Endometriosis UK. It is very informative and educational.